Welcome to Podcast Ed, the podcast of redefinedonline.org, covering the stories behind the new definition of public education. On this episode, Step Up for Students President Doug Tuthill speaks with Denisha Merriweather, the Director of Family Engagement at the American Federation for Children and one of the most vocal advocates of education choice in the nation. Denisha's advocacy is personal. A Florida tax credit scholarship and a safer schooling environment changed the trajectory of her life. Now, after serving as a choice advocate for the Federal Department of Education, Denisha discusses her new project, Black Minds Matter, a movement built to celebrate Black minds, support excellence, and promote the development of high-quality school options. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the episode.
So I'm excited to have Denisha Merriweather with us today. Denisha is a bit of a legend in the education choice movement. I guess we first met when you were in high school.
I think you were
15 or 16 or something like that. And I think I first met you when you were a MC at one of our rallies in Tallahassee, which was pretty amazing for a kid your age. There's, I think, 5,000 plus people there. The governor was on stage with you and you managed the whole thing. So that was sort of your coming out party, don't you think?
Yeah, you're right.
How did you get the poise to stand in front of 5,000 people plus the governor plus the statewide media and basically organize this whole thing and MC it? I mean, what was going on in your mind at that time?
You know, to be honest, I didn't really give much thought to the number of people I would be in front of presenting. I was mostly really, I guess, very sad that I couldn't march because there was a rally, you know, all of these people, thousands of people walking down the street chanting and marching for school choice. And I had to sit still on the stage and not march. And so I was pretty bummed out about that. That was pretty much what I was thinking about the entire time.
So I know your life story has been told many times. But for those few listeners who have been out of the country for the last 15 years and don't know your backstory, can you just real quick give an overview of how you sort of got into the choice movement, really as a young person, and then all the way to what you've been doing the last couple of years?
Yeah, I am from the great state of Florida, so it's been a real treat to be from one of the top school choice states in the country, because I get to see like how my experience impacts, you know, the entire system of education. I grew up in Jacksonville, Florida, and on the east side of Jacksonville, which sits right in what you would think is a prosperous area, but it sits right in the core, and it's a really low income area surrounded by really high income individuals and a lot of business community. But the east side of Jacksonville is really crippled by generational poverty. And I went to my neighborhood schools growing up when I lived with my biological mother. And I failed the third grade twice. I went to schools that I was zoned for, and I didn't feel like I could learn or even had the desire to learn. I was very rude and disrespectful to my teachers. It literally was a place that I had to go in order for my mom not to go to jail. You know, like, there was attendance laws. There are still attendance laws. And I didn't go to school very often. And when I did go to school, I was often confronted by students and teachers who didn't want me there. And so by the time I failed the third grade twice, I really hated going to school. I was 2 years older than everyone in my class, and I felt the pressure from how I performed academically from teachers. When I would read out loud, teachers would just like sigh and try to go to rapidly to another student, and peers, you know, calling me dumb and stupid, and me lashing out in fights and trying to defend myself and, you know, protect my self-esteem. It was very low. I had low motivation and no hope. And I moved in with my godmother the summer before my sixth grade year. She really wanted to change my entire environment. And she started with my school and environment, and the church that she attended started a small private school. And she didn't have a way to pay for it, and so a friend of hers told her about the Step Up for Student Scholarship. And she applied for the scholarship. I got accepted on the scholarship, and I started to go to Esprit de Corps in Jacksonville, Florida, and it really changed my life. I started to go to this really small school, and one of the first things that I noticed is that teachers were really pleased to be working. And now that I'm older, I look back and I think that's really sad that that was one of the first, you know, compare and contrast things that I felt as a student, is that I was actually being loved and cared for, and that the people who were in the school actually wanted me to be there. But that was the first thing. The teachers would greet us with smiles, sit with us at the lunch table instead of retreating to go to the teacher's lounge. And they enjoyed being around us. And so I quickly went from making D's and F's to A's and B's. I went from being a low achieving academically to high achieving. I became the first in my family to graduate from high school. I went on to get a bachelor's degree and a master's degree. And all along the way, I shared my story because I saw the differences between the education that I received and the education that my siblings received. And that's how I was thrust into the space of education reform.
So talk a little about some of the things you did postgraduate. I know you worked for the U.S. Department of Education.
Yeah, so I worked for Step Up for Students. Also, I had the pleasure when I was in grad school at USF to work for Step Up right alongside you and some wonderful others. And after I graduated from grad school, I had the opportunity to go work for Secretary DeVos and in the Office of Communications and Outreach, leading the school choice liaison. I was school choice liaison and youth liaison, which means I really maintain connections with school choice organizations and youth serving organizations. And of course, the school choice part is near and dear to my heart. So highlighting stories of parents, students, and educators, and working with the team to lead the charge to reframe the narrative at the federal level of what school choice actually means, and how more people are actually beneficiaries of this concept of school choice than they actually think. And so that was such a treat. We also led the initiative to meet with other outside organizations who also work in the education reform space, who had never stepped foot in the federal government. And so it was so surprising to hear, because the federal government is an open space for open thinking. And yet there were organizations who are working in the education reform space, in the K-12 education reform space, who had never been allowed or been permitted, or, you know, maybe not making that assumption, but they never had a meeting with any high level officials or any officials in any capacity at the Department of Education. So fostering those relationships, and on the youth serving side, you know, working with the team to maintain connections to youth serving organizations like the YMCA, Boys and Girls Club, the top 10 universities, and things like that.
So what are you doing now today?
Yeah, so today I work at the American Federation for Children, which is a national advocacy organization. We work in three different areas, policy, formation, elections, and in reframing the narrative around school choice in the nonprofit space. So I work in the Office of Communications and Outreach as the Director for Public Relations and Content Marketing, and pretty much doing the same thing, reframing the narrative and making sure when people hear about education freedom, they know that it's something that's attainable and that they can take advantage of it. And if something doesn't exist in their state, it's really empowering them with, you know, knowledge and that power to just go out and demand for something different. And so I've been at AFC for about a year and a half now, And it's been a real treat. And I know we're going to get into Black Minds Matter. And so that's been my my full-time job now since last July with Black Minds Matter.
So, yeah, that's a nice transition. We know after the murder of George Floyd, there was a whole Black Lives Matter movement that really gained a lot of momentum. And then you, several months later, launched what you call Black Minds Matter. Talk a little about that initiative. Where did it come from? And what are you trying to accomplish with it?
Yeah, I'm so excited about it. That's exactly when it launched. It launched after the murder of George Floyd. And, you know, everyone pretty much was looking around and looking internally within organizations, introspectively at, you know, how can we be better? Like, how can we, you know, do something different and impact us, systemic racism, and really make a difference? And so the Black Minds Matter is a project of the American Federation for Children. And that was part of that, you know, whole that thinking process at first, you know, saying like, how can we address this effectively? And pretty much we were all like, we're doing the work, you know, education is a result of systemic racism in this country. The inequalities in the education system is a result of systemic racism. And if we really pull back the layers of why there are so many Black and brown students who are relegated to failing schools in this country, it's because of systemic racism. And so then I penned an op-ed called Black Minds Matter. And that really was the start of this whole movement. And the op-ed basically outlined exactly what I just said and really drawing the links for people to see that, you know, when we're talking about systemic change, focusing, yes, on the criminal justice system and also on the education system and really seeing that those two institutions have really seen limited innovation in this country and how they both need to have awareness and people need to focus on both of these systems at the same time and not just one or the other. And also really pinpointing and letting people know that if you say that you support Black Lives Matter at the social justice space where, you know, you believe that Black bodies shouldn't be haphazardly killed at the hands of police, and you say that you don't support school choice, that you're a hypocrite. You know, like that makes no sense, because there are students in this country every day who are, you know, mentally dying. You know, I will use that phrasing, because when you have startling statistics of Black and brown students who can't read, who are not graduating from high school, who are disproportionately represented in the criminal justice system, we've pinned the term the school to prison pipeline because it's so apparent. And so there are two issues that are not disconnected by any means. And so that's where Black Minds Matter, you know, came from. And I like to say that it's new, but it's not. You know, we've been working in this space and really saying the same thing for many, many years. And it's just really nice to have the catchy title and to frame it, you know, under Black Minds Matter, so people actually understand, people get what we're talking about when we say Black Minds Matter. They get that we're talking about institutional injustices.
So I've been perplexed by the number of Black Lives Matter local chapter leaders who actually have been pretty vocal about their opposition to education choice and education freedom. What's going on there? I mean, why would people who are really trying to change the trajectory of Black folks in this country, particularly about Black youth, why would they not embrace education freedom and empowerment for these families?
Yeah, and it's a great question. There are, you know, fantastic. I separate the social justice movement and the political forces behind that movement, because the foundation of the Black Lives Matter movement is that, like I said, Black boys specifically, but Black bodies in this country shouldn't just be killed haphazardly by police. And that's something that, yes, like, I affirm that. That is exactly right. However, there are, like you mentioned, you know, political forces that are at play within the Black Lives Matter movement that a lot of people are aware of and don't agree with. And one of those political forces are the teachers union. They don't support education freedom because it's a direct threat to their monetary, you know, their pockets. And so they oppose school choice, which is very, it's highly problematic. Because that is one of the ways how you end generational poverty and you end crime and vice within minority communities, specifically Black communities. And so it's a real shame. And that's pretty much why, because the funders behind the Black Lives Matter movement do not support education choice. And there, in turn, these local chapters and the national organizations who are receiving the monies from these political forces, they have to comply with their funders. And, you know, we see a lot of this across the country. And I also say one of the silver linings behind the murder of George Floyd was that a lot of people took a very close look at where their monies were going. They said, who am I funding? Where is, how, I'm spending a lot of my time in XYZ organization. All of my money is going to this place. And they started to ask these really critical questions of, like, are they actually affirming and supporting Black people? You know, like, are they, you know, just, you know, in a lot of people were getting called out. A lot of organizations were being called out because they were not actually supporting at their core the rights of injustice for Black and brown people in this country. And I say that because that's one of the things that I hope to continue. And a lot of people are speaking out against the Black Lives Matter political forces, because when you peel back the covers, you're actually seeing that there are a lot of funders, there are a lot of things, that policies that are being passed that don't actually affirm the progression of minority Black people specifically in this country, and how those things need to change.
You think that the class issues are at play here? You know, you very articulately talked about growing up in poverty, and how education choice was really critical for your transformation. Some of the leaders, you know, have a little more of an affluent background and more of an affluent experience. Do you think that disconnection might be part of what's going on here?
You know, maybe. I don't think entirely. You know, there might be some disconnection at because, you know, once you're away from the neighborhood, once you're away from these people who are actually dealing with real poverty for so long, you kind of, you know, you lose that personal touch. And if you're not interacting with people on a daily basis and hearing their stories, hearing about their struggles and their plight, the things that they, the real needed changes that they need in their community, you become disconnected, and it becomes a class issue. If that's what's going on within the Black Lives Matter movement, I'm not sure about that, but I can definitely see how that would be a bit problematic, because of course communities don't want their sons and their daughters being haphazardly killed at the hands of police, and they also want a good education for their child. They also want community supports and to have something in their community besides corner stores. You know, I mean, you look at these communities, there's pretty much nothing. Where I think about where I grew up, there's nothing for kids, students to do. You know, they're just walking around aimlessly with nothing to do. There are no businesses, no, you know, playgrounds that have organized activities, you know, places for them to go hang out, skating rinks and bowling alleys. Those are not within these communities. And so when you're talking about eliminating crime and vice, you have to think holistically and think about wraparound services. And one of those, the pillars in these communities are education hubs. So if the public schools are not serving the students effectively, you have to try to create some type of innovative options for students so that they can get the things that they need. They can be in loving environments.
You have been an increasingly assertive voice about the importance of Black-owned schools. And I got to tell you, some of my early mentors, when I was early in my political career, came out of the Black Power movement. They were very active in the 60s and 70s, particularly. And they talked a lot about, you know, empowering the community, economic development, controlling the schools. And frankly, I haven't heard a lot of that for a long, long time. And suddenly this new voice, Denisha Merriweather, is talking a lot about the importance of Black-owned schools and a lot of ownership in the community. Talk some about that. Why have you decided to speak out so aggressively on the importance of the Black community owning and managing their own schools?
Under Black Minds Matter, we have the first ever online directory of Black-owned schools. And of course, these are schools of choice. These are private, charter, micro, virtual, homeschool co-ops. These are schools who are owned and operated by Black individuals in this country. And it's nothing new. They've been, you know, people, Rosenwald schools, you know, there have been Black-owned schools for a very long time. Now in the era of school choice, yeah, we don't hear a lot about Black-owned schools. And I know why. It's because it's a major threat to the opposition. You know, Democrats typically receive funding from the teachers union, and oftentimes feel like their arms are twisted to support school choice. Well, all of these Black people who own their schools are their constituents. They're most likely their constituents, and they founded schools, and it's a direct threat to the opposition behind school choice. And we have over about 260 schools across the country. I'm hoping to find more. It's been a real treat and treasure to find these schools and talk with founders to figure out why they decided to do it. Did they even know they were Black-owned? And to talk with them to get their advice and support for other people who are looking to found schools. And I would say the philosophies behind all of these schools are very different. You have some who are, you know, like the Black Power movement, you know, we need to own our own and operate our own and educate our own, but not all of them. You have some Montessori who have just diverse student population and just been working in the space of education reform. And I like to say, you know, with the directory, it is not my goal to say that, hey, Black parents, you should be sending your kids to a Black-owned school. I think that the most important thing is for all schools to be high quality and for all parents to be able to pick whichever type of school they want their kid to go to. It's not enough to just be Black-owned. I think that you need to do have a good curriculum and make it attractive for parents to come to your school. But the simple fact of the matter is that these schools exist, and having a place for them to be highlighted, I've just been so happy to do the work. And it's been getting a lot of traction, highlighting their stories and locating them. And I hope that they get more attention, because the Black founders of these Black-owned schools have been doing such a tremendous job, and they're the real champions out there. And during this whole wave of, you know, highlighting and supporting Black-owned businesses, we don't even talk about Black-owned schools in that conversation. We talked about coffee shops and bookstores and, you know, IT things. And let's talk about schools. And so I have been a really vocal advocate to, when you're talking about Black-owned businesses, I hope you're including schools in that conversation, because there are some schools out there.
How do you feel about the criticism? I'm almost embarrassed to ask this question, but I hear from a lot of my white liberal friends who say, you know, that's going to lead to segregation. You really shouldn't have the Black community owning their own schools. Those kids ought to go to schools and sitting next to white kids. That's what's best for the society. How do you respond to that criticism?
I've actually heard a lot of statements like that, and it's really sad that people do still think that way, or that people think that, you know, there's no need to highlight even Black-owned schools. And I bring it back to the, I just, you know, draw the lines. I'm like, well, we have Montessori schools. We talk about specific types of schools. We have Jewish schools. We have Islamic schools. We have Chinese immersion schools. And, you know, these, you know, you phrase it, white liberals really love the Chinese and Spanish immersion schools and sitting their kids in classrooms full of Chinese. Well, these are, you know, these you're sending, I mean, what's the difference of, you know, going to a school that's Afrocentric and going to a school that's Asian specific, you know? And so it's pretty much the same thing. We just live in such a heated and divided world where anything that's Black and white, we throw up our defense mechanisms, but we celebrate all other types of ethnic groups, and we, you know, celebrate their, I'm not going to say need, but their want to be around their people. And so I think that that's something that I do try to let people know, that this concept of celebrating people's culture and their backgrounds is not, it's not new. And it's something that we should always continue to do, because we live in a melting pot. Like, America is a melting pot, and we shouldn't be trying to become all one color, one culture, one background. We should celebrate our differences and learn more about them.